So there's also some more modern lithography methods, like nano-imprint lithography. So this was invented in Princeton. Okay, it's not so modern, it was already 1994, more than 20 years ago, where you take this kind of mold, which you most probably have fabricated by electron beam lithography. And then you take your resist again. You always need a resist in lithography. And then you just press it. And then you etch a little bit, because you cannot press it so hard that you take every resist away from here. This is just impossible. And then you etch a little bit, you are left with a similar patterned resist as in the case of a lithography, basic lithography. And of course, here you get the resolution of your mold. So if your mold has been fabricated by EBM lithography, electron beam lithography, you get a similar resolution here. And of course, this is much faster. So if you have a big area, you don't need anymore to draw it line by line. You just do that when you make a mold. And then you take your mold, you just stamp it, next chip, stamp it, next chip, and so on. So this is much faster, and this was called breakthrough at that time. Still not in industrial use, because it has also some problems. Photolithography has been developed so much that it still goes over it. Then there's a 3D multiphoton lithography. This means that you have a laser beam, as you can see here. So you have your resist. Usually this resist is thick because you want to make some 3D. So you want to make it high. So this can be even millimeters, centimeters, maybe not centimeters, but millimeters. And then you take your laser. So this means that your laser beam is coming here as a big beam, and then it's focused to this point, and then it deviates again. And in this focus point, you have so much energy that the two photons from your laser can combine and make one more energetic photon. So how to exactly explain this was, I try to use the blackboard to explain it. So you all know that materials or molecules, let's talk about molecules, because resist consists of molecules which react. So you have some molecule and you have a molecule ground state here. This means that a molecule is as relaxed as it can be. Then you have an excited state. And there's certain energy difference between them. And if you have a photon, its energy, this is photon, energy matches to this. You can excite your molecule from ground state to the excited state. And this is known as the absorption of that molecule. It absorbs this, exactly that wavelength, which matches the energy. But now the thing is that the laser you have there, it doesn't have a for this photon. It has a, okay, so it should be basically the frequency is half of that. So this means that your photon can only bring the molecule to this state. So you cannot go to the excited state. But now if you have enough of these photons, you can actually sum them so that two of them will excite the molecule to the excited state. And when it's in the excited state, the reaction happens. which in this case is this cross-linking. Cross-linking. So you expose your resist only at that tiny spot. And now you can move this focus point up and down different places, and you can draw 3D objects in your resist. And what you are left is, for example, this kind of, this looks like a boxing cage, but actually it's a growing place for cells. And as you can imagine, this is not the fastest possible method either. You draw spot by spot, now even in a 3D. But you can make really nice structures. And resolution is actually below the diffraction limit, because this, that you sum up two photons, this is not basic optical property. So it's a nonlinear optics, and that can go below the diffraction limit. Okay, lithography. What we have so far seen is a method to fabricate nanostructures. You always need this resist layer. And after this development, we have a pattern resist layer, and then you have many choices how to continue. As the last line says, usually this is the start of the process, that you have your structure on a resist. Then starts the real process. And growing thin films is the next thing. And some materials for thin films. Well, these are maybe not the ones what you come to your mind first, or there's nothing like a wood or cement or... But there's a more special... Can you guess something? So if you start from here, conductor and element, so single material, say something.
Gold, perhaps.
Yeah, gold is good. Gold is always good. Aluminium, copper, gold, titanium is very common, even if it doesn't. But gold is very much used because it doesn't oxidize. Other common material is a wolfram. I think English name is actually tungsten. Yeah. But all Finnish people understand better wolfram. And molybdenum, tantalum, and silver. So these are not so obvious. Wolfram is a very familiar for everybody from old-fashioned light bulbs. Nowadays, not so much used anymore. Semiconductors, okay, I don't ask it anymore. Silicon, Germany. Germanium is another one, competitor who lost the war with a silicon. That's why we nowadays have a silicon everywhere, not germanium. Insulators. So what is a good insulating element? This is actually tough. There's not many. Single element, very good insulator. There's only one of this type used in a nanofabrication, and that's a diamond. So not the cheapest one, but you can actually fabricate a diamond film pretty easily. You don't get rich by that because they are not so good quality. Then oxides, indium, tin oxide is very common. So this is probably one of the very rare transparent conductors. So you can cover your glass with that and it conducts. So all these places have it. Ruthenium oxide, semiconductors, there's a tin oxide. And of course now, you know, insulators, there's a lot of stuff. So there's a silicon oxide, aluminium oxide, and surprising element, hafnium oxide. It is actually getting very common nowadays. We will get actually back to that soon. Nitrides. You can make nitride almost all of these, usually only these materials, but basically from any metal. gallium nitride is a very common semiconductor. And of course, insulator, you can make a similar nitrides than oxides. Hafnium nitride is not used anywhere, but the boron nitride is. Then other common is, for example, gallium arsenide. So this is very common in a semiconductor nowadays. It's much better than a silicon, but much more expensive also, unfortunately. And downside is also that's a bit poisonous. You know, arsenic. And fluoride polymers. So these are the, I just collected the most common materials used in a nanofabrication. And so we want to make a thin film. You can divide these to two different categories. So there's a physical vapor deposition. Actually, this name, physical vapor deposition, is not used very much, but it still exists because people are just calling different metals by their own name. And this means that you take a material, that big piece we are talking about at the beginning of the lecture. You take that, so somehow release or detach material from it by hammering it, drilling it, whatever, and transport that to your substrate inside the vacuum. Because usually this transporting happens atom by atom. And if you are doing it in the air, you mix it with an air molecule. So you want to do it in a vacuum so you don't get those contaminants. And usually this is for metallic films. So almost all metals are metal films are fabricated by these metals. So the most simplest, what we use here also, actually not the most simplest. So resistive heating. So you just heat your metal, for example, by putting a huge current through it. So it will heat and it will evaporate. And then this gas goes upwards. At some point it hits your surface and makes a solid there. Because the substrate is cold. So it solidifies. So this is very simple. And by that method, so you have your piece of metal, you have your substrate, so your metal atoms are just going directly to your substrate. So vacuum is very good. It doesn't hit any air molecules in a way, they go directly. Which means that they don't go behind the corners. So you can put a mask here easily also, and then you get your metal deposited only these parts. And here it goes to the mask, but not in a substrate because it doesn't go behind the corners. So that's advantage or disadvantage. You can take an advantage of that if you are clever, but it can be sometimes annoying. Then other little bit nicer way is the heating by E-beam. And why it's nicer? It is like it only, you have an electron beam usually coming somewhere. By that, you heat your material and you melt it only here. So this means that you're melting your metal inside the same metal. No contaminants. If you melt the whole piece of metal, like in the first case, you will have to have some kind of cup to hold it, and then the cup can contaminate it. So that's why this is better. Then there's this special heating of the target in a thermal equilibrium within a gas atmosphere, okay. Reading that, you probably don't have any idea what's happening. But what it means is that you have this kind of bottle. You have your metal here. You start heating it. You generate metal gas of that same metal. Okay, it can be something else than a metal also, but so it can be semiconductor very often, actually it is semiconductor. But your material is solid here and a gas here, and you have a constant exchange of atoms here between the gas and the solid. So it's in a thermal equilibrium. And this depends on the temperature. Now, how you deposit it, you make a really tiny hole here. So tiny that there basically comes only single atom at a time, and they travel to your substrate. And how to make so tiny pieces? Basically, you can calculate the density of your, because it's a thermal equilibrium, you can calculate the density of your gas. You know how many atoms there is per cubic centimeter, and you can estimate that which size hole you need to do, so that it only comes one by one. So that's, you have basically molecular beam or atomic beam. So that's why this beam. And then they hit your substrate, which is usually heated also. And so substrate is heated, so it means that these atoms still have energy due to thermal energy. So they diffuse and you can grow single crystals. So this is a specialty for that. In evaporation, you never get single crystals because atoms come to your substrate and they hit some place and stay there. That's it. And they come randomly. You always get amorphous, but by this you get single crystals. Sputtering, we will look a little bit more, next slide. But laser bombardment, it should be actually laser ablation. Sorry, I didn't notice. Ah, it's called laser ablation, yeah. So this means that instead of electron beam, you put the pulses of laser to your, so let's take a laser here, we still have the same material here. And you basically heat it locally so much that it will evaporate everywhere as a plasma. And in that case, the target is usually very close. So this is one way. But what is a sputtering then? This is the most common, so that's why we look at it a little bit more. So you have this kind of system. So you have a sputtering target. So this target means this material, what we evaporated or what we want to deposit. Then you put in some sputtering gas, for example, argon. Argon is good because it doesn't react. And you put a big voltage in a sputtering target and a substrate, between sputtering target and a substrate. And what happens there is that you have let's put a simplified model of atom, this kind of kindergarten model, so you have a nucleus and single electron, and then many electrons inside of that. And you put big voltage, so you put big electric field, actually. What happens? It accelerates. Let's put it the other way, because electrons are negative, so let's make a correct picture. Electrons are accelerated, of course, different direction than this. And if you put high enough field, you can rip off this electron from the atom. What happens then? It sees a next atom here. It hits that and kicks off that electron, which are both accelerated by the electric field. And then they hit an again atom. Okay, and you see the picture. Soon, all your atoms are without electrons. Because every time you increase the number. And what you get is a plasma, which means that you have only nucleuses, which don't have or it can have still some electrons, but the outer electrons are taken away. So they are kind of positive ions and electrons. So it's this kind of mess of electrons and ions. And that's, at that point it starts to glow. You can see the light coming out. And you still have this electric field. And what do you think happens here is, of course, the ions are accelerated towards the field and electrons opposite to the field, but electrons move much faster because they are much, much smaller than these ions. And what happens is you lose most of your electrons, you have more positive ions, and your voltage goes up. And if you think that this is your, where to draw that it will be visible, so here, if you think this is your target, this is your substrate, and then you have put this voltage there, so this should be negative, and this should be positive, like this. And your plasma is inside here, so you lose most of the electrons, so they are going to your substrate, hopefully not harming it. This is one of the people try to avoid. But in this plasma, you have a much more ions. It means that you have a initial kind of zero voltage level here. So now we have combined picture of a voltage and a positioning. What happens, you have a positive voltage here. Usually this part is grounded, so it goes to zero at some point. But here you have a huge negative voltage, but still in a plasma, because it's conducting, there cannot be potential difference. You know, inside a metal, there's the same potential everywhere. So the plasma is like a metal. You have a huge potential drop here. And here you have your negative voltage. And now ions would come to this area will be accelerated a lot, because these ions are positive, as drawn here. They are accelerated a lot, and they hit the target to a really high velocity. This is basically that you take a hammer and you hammer pieces from your material, and they just fly away. So this is exactly what happened. But now, these pieces that fly away are atoms. And then they are just traveling around until they hit the substrate and stay there. Of course, they can stay in chamber walls also, but those are lost cases then. So you basically cover everything with your atoms. So basically it's hammering. Then you have a chemical vapor deposition, which is different than a physical vapor deposition. And how it's different is that you don't take your target material as it is, but you take several precursors, which are usually gas or vapor, and then they react on a surface. So and how do you make certain that they react only on a surface is usually that you heat your surface. And this reaction needs heat to happen. So they, in a gas phase, they don't react because they don't have energy. But as soon as they meet at the surface, they react because they got the heat thermal energy from a surface. And this is kind of any kind of a dielectric compound. So as this physical vapor deposition was for metals and single like elements, then this is for any compounds. It's a better method, this one. Because of course, in a physical vapor deposition and sputtering, you can also, if you have a compound, you can basically break your compound. And that's not desired. But here, you can kind of put the precursors, and then they react together and form a film. So this is a typical case. So you have a precursors coming in as a gas. You have constant flow. Actually, very big part of this precursors just flow out, not reacting. And some of these will go to the surface and react together and make a solid. So you have to dose your precursors so that they are gas, and then they react, that's a solid. And if you have some byproduct, that should not be the solid, because then it's left on your substrate also, but you wanted that to take away. So careful needs to be taken when deciding your chemical reaction here. So this is kind of opposite. And then of course here, you can actually increase the speed of this. So you, as I said, you use thermal energy to make it happen on a substrate. Sometimes it's not possible. Then you can add some other energy. And then you do similar plasma as in the putrin. You take your precursors, you make plasma out of them. Then they are ions or excited pieces, and they react much more easily in lower temperatures. So plasma can be used, and then it's called PECVD, so it's called plasma enhanced CVD. Plasma enhanced chemical vapor deposition. This is very common also. And sometimes it's that you can do it by thermal energy, but your substrate cannot stand it. If you have made already 1 million transistors there and you want to cover it some oxide, which you want to use a chemical vapor deposition, you don't want to heat your transistors to 1,000 degrees. They most probably break. So then you use this plasma enhanced CVD to make it at a lower temperature. Okay, so this was basic about how to grow films. The other method was etching, removal of material. There's basically two categories, basic categories, wet etching and dry etching. And dry etching usually means that you use plasma, so some people call it plasma etching. So wet etching is really simple. So you take some solid like a silicon and you react it. So here you can see the hydroxyl ion. I hope it was correctly pronounced. Hydroxyl ions. So usually by that you make, for example, potassium hydroxide, KOH. This is actually the same what you put in a home. If your pipe is blocked and you buy from a store this pipe opener, it's this gallium hydroxide or potassium hydroxide. And you mix that in the water and put your silicon there. What you get out is this kind of compound. It's a silicon dehydroxide something oxide. And this is this AQ means that it's soluble to water, so it's aqueous. So this will be taken away by water, and then you got a little bit hydrogen out as a bubbles. G means gas. So your silicon is changed to the soluble compound, which is taken away, and you produce some hydrogen gas. So your silicon is etched away. This is the most common etching process on wet etching. But of course, as you can think, this kind of happens in every direction. If you have a surface, you have a, is this visible? Yeah, it's visible. You have your resist, which you have patterned, but whatever lithography. And then you start your etching. And here comes these OH ions from everywhere, and they are hitting your surface. So you start etching at every point. So you're basically, you are etching everywhere. But as soon as you create vertical walls, it also starts etching. So you are also etching this direction, horizontal direction, as soon you have this kind of hollow space. And this is called isotropic etching, So it means that it goes the same speed every direction. In a plasma or dry etching, you have a solid and you have a gas. For example, tetrafluoride, carbon tetrafluoride, which you mix with silicon. And usually you make plasma out of this CF4. And what you get is this fluoride is very reactive and it reacts with silicon, making silicon fluoride, which is gaseous, and it will be pumped away. And then you make a carbon dioxide, which is also gas and pumped away. So final end is you turn your silicon dioxide to the silicon fluoride. As a solid silicon dioxide is turned to the gaseous silicon fluoride and pumped away. So you are etching, eating your material away. And most common method in this kind of a dry etching is so-called reactive ion etching. So I selected also here the most common. So this means that you take a similar chamber than your sputtering chamber. So let's take everything else out. Let's leave our sputtering chamber here. I think we don't need this explanation here anymore. So we have our material precursor in the middle. And it just pumped big flow from here and here out. Flow of precursors. And now we put the same kind of voltage to make it plasma. And we got the same kind of a voltage division here. So plasma is positive because it loses electrons and you have a biggest voltage difference here and a little bit here. And now what happens is that, it's set there. Yes. So in this case, you can have your substrate here. And this is just an electrode. Nothing is happening there except applying voltage. And what happens now in your substrate is that here you have a, for example, what was our, it was CF4. So this is flow of CF4. What you have here is of course carbon ions, but especially you have excited. So let's put this star as an excited fluor. And you most probably you have also argon. Which means you have argon ions also inside. What happens now is that these argon ions, they are accelerated as in a sputtering to your substrate. And they bring energy to the substrate. Also, you have this fluoride, which very easily reacts. This is a, let's talk about this, our example, silicon dioxide. Oh, actually in this slide is a silicon. Yeah, it works for both. So let's talk about silicon. This fluoride easily reacts with silicon. And as we bring energy by this argon bombardment, it reacts even more easily. And also, actually, in this process, you have oxygen coming. So oxygen is needed for this chemical reaction to happen also. So basically, you have also excited single oxygen, which every chemist knows is very reactive. So, and you can tune your process. So how much you have an argon bombardment? By increasing pressure inside, you have too much too much atoms, too much ions, they collide and they really don't accelerate so much. Then you don't have a bombardment, or you can make a pressure really low that the argon ions don't hit any other atoms and they really accelerate the whole, this whole distance. Then they have a huge energy when they hit the surface. So you can tune your process. If you have a really hydrogen argon ions, it's basically sputtering already. You sputter your material away. It's also etching. It's a sputter etching. But that's not selective. It will sputter whatever is there. But if you make it lower and you have a fluoride, it's only reactive with silicon, then you are selective. Then you etch a silicon. And if you make this argon sputtering really small, it's basically only chemical reaction, and you talk about chemical plasma etching. And you can do whatever in between. So you can tune your etching process a lot. So that's why this is very common device, because depending on the case, you can tune how much sputtering etching you have and how selective your etching is and so on. And also since this is kind of sputtering from one direction, you can also easily etch so that you have your resist here, again made by whatever lithography, and then you etch from here. Here comes fluoride and here comes argon, both. And you start etching only in a vertical direction, so anisotropic etching. So that's why this is the most common. So as you see, the plasma is actually very important. Both in a PVD and a CVD, the most common method uses plasma. Okay. So this is kind of end of phase top-down lithography part. And as there's a question, are these top methods actually used in microprocess fabrication? Yes. All of these, and in addition, you need all of these. So that's a lot. I don't remember now who, but somebody will give us a lecture after 3 weeks. Let's talk a little bit about bottom up, but maybe before going that, there's a good time for make the second break. So let's continue on a 10 past.